Well, good morning. Welcome. Thanks for coming. Let's go ahead and open in prayer, and then we will start our presentation. Let's pray. Our Father and God, we are so thankful to you for showing us grace, for loving us. Father, we're thankful for the ACCS and the work being done by all the schools and by Patch and his team. And Father, as we look at teaching today, we pray that you would give us grace. And as we reflect on what good teaching looks like, pray that this would be a good opportunity for us to continue the conversation and bring these good ideas back to our respective schools. We do ask you to bless us in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, again, welcome. My name is Ryan Evans. I am the headmaster at Providence Classical Christian School in the Seattle area, and I've been there for 6 years. Did I hear a shout-out for Seattle? Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you. Got some friends here. So I've been in administration for 11 years and taught for 7 years, and so really the presentation today is sort of a combination of my what I took from teaching and then just observing in classrooms. So how many people here are administrators? Just show of hands, curious administrators. Okay, and how about teachers, people in the classroom? So we have a good mix, maybe about 50-50. So I hope the ideas here will be both profitable for administrators and for teachers. So 10 traits of the exemplary teacher. These ideas also come from a lot of reading. I like to read, especially books on education. And so what you'll see, and you'll see that in your handout, are a lot of quotes. I've left the trait off just so I could keep people coming to the conference. Otherwise, you wouldn't have needed to attend. It would all be there for you. I also have a book list that I am saving for the end, so make sure you get that on your way out. Recommended books for each of the traits, and if nothing else, I hope people can take from this conference recommendations, because there's a lot of great stuff out there that we can learn from. So, 10 traits. Why this topic? Well, as I said, this has been something that has been meaningful to me, and as I observe teachers, I've come to the realization that teaching's hard. For those who have taught, teaching is hard, and we're going to talk about that here today. But exemplary, you know, there's a big difference between an A teacher and a B teacher. And what I've tried to do is look at those traits that separate the mediocre or even the good teacher from the exemplary teacher, your master teacher. So why exemplary? Well, let's define that term as we start here. Exemplary, serving as a pattern, deserving imitation, commendable, serving as an example. And so a teacher who has mastered all these 10 things is really your master teacher, is your exemplary teacher. And quite honestly, we talked about this yesterday in the pre-conference. Not every school is going to, you know, not every teacher is going to be an exemplary teacher. There's a lot of things to work on. And so I hope you can take away some tips and some things from this lecture on that. I've divided them into two categories. The first one are personal traits. What kind of person are we looking to hire? What kind of person makes the best teacher? And then the second one, and of course there's overlap here, but the second one are professional or teaching traits. And can you have one without the other? I think you can. In fact, I remember supervising a teacher who was a wonderful man, a wonderful godly man, and exhibited the kinds of things that we'll talk about today in terms of personal traits, but just did not have the teaching traits. And those make for very hard conversations if you're an administrator, is sitting down with someone like that and really counseling that person out of teaching. So you need the personal traits, and you also need those professional traits. Before we start, think about what traits that you would suggest for the most important teaching or character traits for the exemplary teacher. And let's just take maybe a minute, write down a piece of scratch paper or on your outline there, 6 to 10 things that come immediately to your mind. You've probably thought about this before, but what comes immediately to your mind when you think of master teacher, exemplary teacher? So I'm going to give you about 60 seconds to do that, and then you can compare your notes with the traits that I'm going to present here in a moment. Take about 15 more seconds. 15 seconds. Okay, let's move on. So the first trait, the format really here today is, I'm going to give that quote and then I'll give you the trait, so feel free to write that in on your outline. But I'm going to start with the book of Galatians, fruits of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Those who belong to Christ Jesus have crucified the sinful nature with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. So really the start, I think, of any good teacher in the Christian school is someone who lives a gospel-oriented life. I think it's got to start there. And I think we'd all be on board with that. This is the first prerequisite for any teacher in our schools. If someone does not have a relationship with the Lord, is not committed to pursuing Christ-likeness in his or her life, they're disqualified, at least within the ACCS. So this is the first one. I put it number one on purpose. Jesus says in Luke 6 that a student is not above his teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like his teacher. And I have kids in our school. I'm sure many of you have your own kids in your school. And as you look at teachers, this is what you want. You want a model of Christ-likeness. Not a perfect person. Perfection is only found in Christ. But we do want someone who models consistently those fruits of the Spirit, where I can tell my son or daughter, look to him, look to her. J.C. Ryle, in his book Holiness, and if you haven't read this one, I'd put it at the top of your list, says, true holiness does not consist merely of inward sensations and impressions. It is something of the image of Christ, which can be seen and observed by others in our private life and habits and character and doings. And the whole book is full of just amazing advice from a godly man. And as we pursue holiness, that's what hopefully our teachers are modeling for our kids. Mark Schwen, in his book, Everyone a Teacher, says, I have come increasingly to think that good teaching depends as much on the character of the teacher as it does upon his or her grasp of the subject matter. So the character, our character, comes out in our teaching. In fact, I've heard it said, the teacher is the curriculum. You've heard that phrase before, and it is true. You might have a wonderful curriculum and books and supporting materials, but if the teacher isn't modeling that kind of character, it's actually more pernicious than it is good. Gilbert Hyatt, again, don't need to write down all the names of the books because I have a book list for you afterwards, but particularly for secondary teachers, Hyatt's book, he was a professor of classics at Columbia, and his book, The Art of Teaching, is a wonderful book if you haven't read that yet. He talks about kindness, the importance of kindness. And he says, this kindness must be genuine. Pupils of all ages, from careless children up to hardworking graduates, easily and quickly detect the teacher who dislikes them, as easily as a dog detects someone who is afraid of him. It is useless to feign a liking for them if you do not really feel it. This will lead us into our next trait as well, but someone who lives a gospel-oriented life exudes kindness, exudes love and charity and those fruits of the Spirit. In fact, I can remember as a teacher, every once in a while you get a note that's worth keeping. You probably have a file of those where you have those notes that are worth saving because they're just very meaningful. And I actually have one that I'm going to read just a portion of because this one stuck with me. It was written in 99. This is 13 years old, but I can still remember it and I still treasure it. This is from a parent. And she says, I've been meaning to drop you a note for a few weeks now. Our daughter has enjoyed you so much this year. There have been many times that she's gotten in the car and I ask, how was your day? She'll answer, good. Mr. Evans is so nice. She conveyed the times you've let them play outside, inside, and games, etc. But the one thing that she mentioned a number of times, and it's something she'll always remember, is that you show mercy. You have been more Christ-like to her than any other teacher, and I'd like you to know how that has touched her life. And then she writes a few more things. I don't read that simply to boast. I don't have a huge treasure trove of these, right? You don't get many of these, but when you do get them, you keep them. And sadly, there are times when we let kids down. You know, there are times when we let kids down, and those are great opportunities. I can remember it was close to this time when I had a student who I had to call in and just apologize to. If you've ever had to do that with a student, it's a humbling thing to do. I had just I had not done him right, and in a conversation with his mom, I thought, okay, he deserves an apology from me. And so those kinds of things are tough. We hope to avoid those, but nevertheless, those come up as well. Okay, trait number two, which is somewhat related to the first one, living a gospel-oriented life. And I'm starting with a quote from Bruce Lockerbie. Christian schooling is a calling, a high calling, and no one called to Christian schooling can ever heed that call without remaining, again, in the best sense of the word, an amateur. Someone who does what she does not just for the money but for the love of it. Administering or teaching isn't just a skill to be mastered or a science to be reduced to a formula. It's an art to be loved. So this trait is what I'm calling called to teach and serve. And notice it's teach and serve, because there are certain people who might want to teach, but they've sort of defined teaching as something outside of service or vocation in that sense. In fact, one author I was reading said she was in an interview. It was Lane McEwen. She said she was in an interview with a prospective teacher. And she said, why do you want to teach at our school? And the first thing out of this lady's mouth was, well, I'm looking for a job that pays me full-time benefits. And for Elaine McEwen, that interview is over, as it should have been. That is not what we're talking about when we're talking about vocation. Ron Berger, in his book, An Ethic of Excellence, says, teaching is hard. Harder than I can ever explain to anyone. Doing it well consistently takes a unique stamina. For anyone with talent and options, choosing to enter teaching and giving up the money, flexibility, and respect that so many other careers offer in order to take on the stress of the classroom is just crazy. Unless you see teaching as a calling. Unless you feel that teaching is what you are intended for, that it is your way to share the best of what you have to give to the world. Amen to that. Gene Veith talks about vocation in his book, God at Work. He says, the purpose of vocation is to love and serve one's neighbor. This is the test, the criterion, the guide for how to live out each and every vocation anyone can be called to. How does my calling serve my neighbor? And in teaching, like any job, you have what's called side work, right? Side work. I was talking with one of our teachers who used to work at the Cheesecake Factory, and he said side work for him at the Cheesecake Factory was the kinds of things that everyone had to do, but it wasn't your primary thing. You had to fill the ketchup bottles and make sure there's enough salt and pepper on the tables and all those kinds of things. But it was side work, and people didn't love it. But nevertheless, it was a part of what that was like. And I thought, you know, teaching's a little bit like that. We love to be with the students. We love to be in front teaching and engaging them in learning. But there are things that aren't maybe at the top of our list. But nevertheless, we're called to do those things. We're called to serve in that way. So grading is like that. Checking email, whether you like it or not. When I get to my office every morning, there are new emails and lots of them. And that's just a part of what we do. Attending meetings. Attending conferences, planning lessons, carpool duty or recess duty, reading books, continuing your ongoing education, delivering lessons, and of course, communicating with parents. I've heard teachers before sort of grumble about having to respond to parents, and especially in light of Tom's discussion on in loco parentis, you know, we should welcome that. We are partnering with parents. We're not partnering with students in terms of our education. We're partnering with parents. And so we should want to, you know, I know there are some tough phone calls, but we should want to call that parent up or see that parent in the hallway and talk about how their son or daughter is doing. David Hicks, in his book, Norms and Nobility, moving on here to trait three, says, how well do you know your students? If you do not know them well, what might that say about your attitude toward them and toward teaching? How might that attitude affect your ability to teach effectively? So trait three is what I'm calling student-focused, and this takes a little bit of unpacking. Again, Gilbert Hyatt, if you wish to influence students in any way, you must convince them that you know them as individuals. The first step toward this is memorizing their faces and names. I love it when I observe classes. I love it when teachers use names all period long. I'm also the secondary principal, so I'm in a lot of secondary classrooms. And even with secondary students, use their name. Use their name constantly. In fact, I challenge people, make sure you call on every student, mention every student's name at least once during that period, during that 45 minutes. It's good to be aware of that. Know your kids. Picture is worth a thousand words. This is my daughter when she was in second grade, and she invited her teacher, Mrs. Jacobson, to her birthday party, and Mrs. Jacobson showed up. And so we got this picture of all the girls in the class, and one of her cousins is there too. But, you know, teachers who invest in time outside of the classroom, those are priceless investments. And we're all busy. I understand that. You can't go to every piano recital and every baseball game and every birthday party. But, boy, if you can invest in students just beyond classroom, that is worth a lot. It sends an amazing message to the kids. Todd Whitaker says in his book, until we connect with students emotionally, we may never be able to connect with their minds. Great educators understand that behaviors and beliefs are tied to emotion, and they understand the power of emotion to jumpstart change. You've heard of that phrase, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And it sounds trite, it sounds like a cliche, it kind of is a cliche, I guess, but it is so true. That's a harder one sometimes to get across to secondary teachers. There is a difference between a grammar mentality and a secondary mentality. And grammar teachers generally get that intuitively. They're tend to be much more nurturing. And secondary folks can sometimes have a little bit of more of a, hey, I'm here to teach, I'm here to deliver lessons, I love my subject, which is great too. But to impress upon your teachers the importance of getting to know these kids, being focused not on a group or material, but understanding that each individual brings something different to the classroom. In fact, I read a study recently that said the master teachers teach to 16 individuals, not to a class of 16. And the research has been done to show that when I can, as a teacher, appeal to each individual person in my room, that's going to raise, you know, the academic success and make me a better teacher. I can remember as a sixth grade teacher, I taught sixth grade for 7 years, and I had a student who was the ideal student. She was capable. She worked really hard. Socially, she was just a great friend to her peers. She spiritually was a wonderful leader, and I was so excited to have her in my room. And a couple months into the school year, I was talking with her dad about a different issue, and he said, you know, can I share something with you? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, Brianna feels like you don't like her. And have you ever had those conversations when your stomach just kind of falls and you think, how could that be? And so as we talked further about it, I realized I had, I think, 25 or 26 kids in my class that year, and some fairly challenging kids. And I was spending so much time on some of those more challenging kids that I had ignored my better ones. And that was a total wake-up call to me. And I thanked him for sharing that with me, and I was able to, it didn't take long when you understand that and have that awareness. It doesn't take long to come back and, you know, show her that appreciation and show her that affirmation that she needed. And by the end of the year, She had had a wonderful year, but the first couple months wasn't so great, and that was on me. That was my responsibility. Parker Palmer, in his book Courage to Teach, says schools like hospitals exist to help people. Complaining about our students is similar to a doctor saying, "Don't send us any more sick people. We don't know what to do with them. Send us healthy patients so we can look like good doctors." You know, it's so easy to work with the National Merit kids. They're engaged. They bring so much to the table. Who doesn't love working with those kids? But we'll talk about this a little bit later. The sign of the exemplary teacher isn't that he or she can work with those top-level kids. It's that he or she can work with any of the students in the room. Trait number four. A teacher should have some interests beyond his or her specialty. In bearing and manner of thinking and talking, a teacher should quite naturally appear to be a person with a mental life. A person who reads books and whose conversations with colleagues is not purely business shop, that is, not invariably methods and troubles, but substance as well. There is no hope of attracting students to any art or science and keeping up with their interest without this spontaneous mental radiation. That's from Jacques Barzan. When you interview teachers, do you ask them questions about their own learning, their own growth, their own personal self-study? One of the questions we have on our application is list 5 or 10 books you've read in the last year and write a little bit about that book and what you thought of it and what that meant to you. And what we're getting at with that, I'm sure many of you do the same thing, is I want to find out, what is this person like as a learner? That whole term, lifelong learner, has kind of become a little bit cliche too, but we want somebody who is pursuing that level of engagement in his or her own life. And quite honestly, you know, technology is a challenge. You know, with Facebook and the internet and the iPod and all those kind of things, which can be wonderful tools. But I fear, and you've probably seen this in your schools as well, I fear that is a huge barrier at times to pursuing a life of the mind. And studies on online reading versus reading actual books and things reveals some of those very real challenges. So as we're talking with prospective teachers, we want to know, what have you read? What do you like to study? Gilbert Hyatt again, first and most necessary of all, he must know the subject. This is not to say we talk about, you know, loving the Lord and being called to teach. We do want to hire people who understand what they're teaching, right? I mean, that's sort of a prerequisite as well. We've got to find people who are the right fit for our schools and the right fit for that position. You might be hiring someone for looking for a fifth grade teacher, and you talk to someone, and you think, wow, great for middle school English, but not the right fit for that position. John Milton Gregory, The Seven Laws of Teaching. The unknowing teacher is the blind trying to lead the blind with only an empty lamp to light the way. Have you ever been in a situation where you're in front of a class and you realize, I don't really think I know what I'm talking about? It happened to me once. I was subbing for Bible, and it was an eighth grade class, and it was eighth grade, so I thought, I can do this. But I had one of those National Merit kids, and I realized real quick, I'm in trouble. And I said something. He said, I'm not sure that's right. And I said, well, why don't you go ahead and see if you can find that? It was Bible class. And I thought, I can get through 20 minutes. He won't be able to find that in 20 minutes. I can be out of this class. Well, he found it in about 5. And I had to say, you know what, you're right. Thank you for pointing that out. I was unprepared. I didn't know that subject, and just kind of it was a sort of an emergency sub situation. But that's an uncomfortable position to be in. We've got to have people who love the subject and people who love learning. T.S. Eliot said, "No one can become liberally educated without having pursued some study in which he took no interest. For it is part of education to learn to interest ourselves in subjects for which we have no aptitude. I recommend our teachers read beyond their comfort level. If you're a Bible teacher, great, read applied Bible and theology, but make sure you're reading fiction. You know, read some great fiction authors. Read children's literature. Read some of the books that the students are reading. So read beyond your expert area. I expect our English teachers to love novels and to love literature and the classics, but I also want them, you know, to be reading books on Bible or devotionals. Read something by John Piper or read some history books. And there's a lot as administrators we can do to encourage that. In fact, the ACCS certification is one way to do that, is to have book lists and encourage that kind of reading. I remember when I was going through a master's program, one of my most reluctant students in my class, he was a boy, he was one of those sports-minded guys, but he was a fairly sharp kid, but fairly apathetic and somewhat of a reluctant learner. And I asked at the end of the year, I just did a little survey and asked for their input. And one of the things he said is he said, "I like the fact that Mr. Evans has to learn too." And I had, you know, I'd come in, I'd say, "Well, I'm working on this paper, working on this project for my master's program." And so I'd share that a little bit with the kids, just so they knew that, hey, this is something that not just students do, it's actually something that we adults do as well. And so trying to model that and look for opportunities to do that is important. So not only loving the subject, but love learning and showing that passion to our kids. Trait number 5. Students are reading, writing, taking notes, manipulating materials, doing experiments, drawing diagrams, answering questions, asking questions, listening, using a computer or calculator, interacting in small groups with their fellow students, or talking with the teacher. They look involved. Their eyes follow the teacher as the teacher moves about the room. They're alert, energetic, and even their posture and body language suggest engagement. There might even be a palpable sense of excitement in a classroom when students are engaged. So number 5 is engaging and inspiring. I'm sure as administrators you've been in rooms before where there is that palpable sense. Kids are excited. They're even almost giggling. They're so excited. I was in a school recently where I saw that. It's just such a treasure to be a part of that and just to watch that. And it was math. They were on the ground doing math manipulatives, and the kids were just so excited for it. That's what we're talking about with engaging and inspiring teaching. So I thought by means of a video we'd watch a little something here, if I can get this to work. You've probably seen this before. Ask yourself, is this what we mean by engaging and inspiring? Okay, so that's obviously an example of what not to do. There are actually some good things that teacher did. We don't have time to probably get into that, but at least, you know, he was asking questions and doing some things. But that's the antithesis of engaging and inspiring. And don't you love those looks of the learners? That's not that palpable sense of excitement that we're talking about. John Medina, in his book Brain Rules, says, "The more attention a brain pays to a given stimulus, the more elaborately the information will be encoded. and retained. So one of the things when we talk about engaging and inspiring, sometimes we think of those teachers who are really gregarious and maybe they have wonderful senses of humor and very active and extremely energetic. And that's great. That can be one style. But I think it's important to point out that that's not the only style that can engage and inspire learners. So I don't want to misrepresent and say, you know, it's a personality type. There are a lot of different personality types in teaching, and we need different personality types because sometimes the highly energetic person can drive some kids crazy. I remember Cindy Tobias in her book, The Way They Learn. I had an opportunity to hear her speak once, and she said she was one of those people that was just gregarious and liked to change things around. And so every day when she started teaching, she'd shift the desks around and put, you know, new positions and stuff. And she thought, isn't this great? The kids are going to love it. Well, certain kids did love it. But certain kids in that room, in fact, one little guy, I think, finally went and said to her, can you stop moving those desks around? You know, this was a kid who didn't, you know, that really gregarious and energetic personality, that was almost too much for him. And so sometimes different styles can be really good, but different styles can be engaging and inspiring as well. I love this quote. This is my 38th year teaching fifth grade, but for these students, it's the first time around. And particularly if you're a veteran teacher and you've been teaching a certain grade level or a certain subject, for years and years, it's easy to fall into that routine, get the lesson plan out, here it is, open it up, I know this, I don't even need to check, don't even need to look at lessons. But the best teachers, the exemplary teachers, are reinventing things. They're studying, they're bringing in new ideas, they're trying new things, taking risks. I love it when I talk to a teacher who says, man, I tried something new, it was just an absolute bomb. Isn't that a great thing? I say, hey, thank you. It's great that you're trying new things. Not that it bombed, but you know what? Sometimes you plan lessons and you think, this is going to be a disaster. And it's great. The kids eat it up. They love it. And other times you plan something and you put time in and you think, you know, this is going to be great. And it just bombs. But that's teaching. Exemplary teachers try new things. They make it new and they realize, hey, these are new kids. I have new students every year. John Medina, again, says, we don't pay attention to boring things. We're not wired that way. If information is presented orally, people remember about 10%, tested 72 hours after exposure. That figure goes up to 65% if you add a picture. That's pretty amazing, that statistic. So Brain Rules is full of those kinds of things. I don't agree with John Medina on everything, but he has some really good tidbits in terms of how the brain works. If you've ever seen Dead Poets Society and William Keating, he'd be a nightmare to supervise. But he's a fabulous teacher. He's so engaging and inspiring. And you remember that scene where he says, he introduces himself and says, my name's Mr. Keating. Or if you're really brave, you can call me, oh, Captain, my Captain. And the look on the boys' face, they kind of look at each other like, is this guy serious? Because they're used to this. It's this Ivy League prep type school in the East Coast. And they look at each other like, this guy's not normal. This is not what we're used to. But he's definitely engaging and inspiring. I had a teacher like that in high school. And her name was Mrs. Strand. I can still remember Mrs. Strand. In fact, some of the lessons I learned from Mrs. Strand, I still remember today. She taught science, and we had a unit on botany, and botany isn't one of those things that I wouldn't think high school students get tremendously excited about, and I wasn't tremendously excited about it, but boy, she made it really engaging. She brought in, I mean, she was so passionate about it herself, and so that was infectious, but she would bring in, plant, you know, leaves, and we'd look at leaf structures, and she'd give us these mnemonic devices, cedar swoops and hemlock droops and those kinds of things, and for the exam, we didn't just look at a textbook or look at pictures. She actually took us on a field trip to her house, and she walked us through her backyard. And we had a sheet with numbers on it, and she said, okay, that's number one. And we'd have to write down, you know, blue spruce, whatever it happened to be. And she had lemonade and cookies and stuff for us. And I thought, you know, that is the above and beyond type. That's the sign of an exemplary teacher, someone who makes learning engaging and inspiring and sort of thinks outside the box. Did we learn the material? Absolutely. Was it unconventional? Yeah. And again, not that you have to do that with every lesson or every unit, but those are the kinds of ideas, those are the kinds of things that make learning engaging and inspiring to students. Number six. This is from Gene Veith and Andrew Curran's book, Classical Education, The Movement Sweeping America. They say, classical education goes against the grain of much contemporary culture. It makes pampered children work hard. It forces the television generation to read. Teachers will have to convince students that the good, the true, and the beautiful will have more value than the glittering prizes of pop culture and the easy answers of relativism. How many parents will be like those who pulled their children from Marva Collins' school because she demands too much? And we'll talk a little bit about Marva Collins briefly here in a moment. But basically, she started classical education in an urban setting with poverty-stricken kids and was able to work amazing things because she had high expectations. So that's trait number six. High expectations. If you think of your favorite teachers that you've had, maybe high school teachers, maybe college teachers, maybe even your grammar school elementary teachers, likely they challenged you. At least when I think of the ones I had, they challenged me. They didn't settle for pat answers. They didn't settle for sort of a marginal effort. They demanded more from me. And the best teachers have high expectations, not simply for the high-level learners, but even for the low-level learners. They maintain high expectations. This is from Elaine McEwen's book, 10 Traits of Highly Effective Teachers. She says, highly effective teachers do not merely set forth their expectations and let those students who are unmotivated or less able fail. Nor do they have one set of expectations for high-achieving students and another for low-achieving students. Highly effective teachers articulate their expectations and then provide supportive, systematic instruction that enables every child to achieve far more than that child would have with low expectations. You've seen those studies on expectations where they'll have two different groups that are just randomly chosen, and so they're ostensibly they are even groups. And they tell one teacher, hey, you're getting a really highly motivated group. You're getting a group of high achievers, so make sure you challenge them. And they tell another teacher, hey, these are a little bit more of a reluctant learners. They haven't achieved real well. They struggle with, they have some learning difficulties, but do the best you can. And they've done those studies before, and it's shocking the result. Again, there's no difference in the kids. They've been purposeful about saying there is no difference in these students. But by the end of the year, one group achieves way more than the other group. And it's that expectation that the teacher had, knowing ahead of time, or feeling ahead of time, being told ahead of time, these were high-level kids. These are motivated kids. Make sure you have high expectations. And the other group tended to, you know, gravitate to that lowest common denominator because the teacher didn't maintain those expectations. Oops, I think I missed one there. Okay, Marva Collins. Love this quote. The teacher who can only work with the well-motivated child and the well-behaved child has no place at Westside Preparatory School. I want teachers who will make the slow student become good and the good student become superior. We all know that we're going to have some students who maybe just don't have the same ability as the higher level kids, and that's okay. That's how God has created them. And so our job isn't to get every kid to that A level. Some kids don't have the ability to do that. But if you can take a C student and make him or her a B student, that's success. And that's what we're talking about with high expectations. I've had experiences before supervising teachers where and we have a rule at our school that if you have, I think it's 20%, Fs you need to inform the administrator just so we can be aware of kind of trends in the classroom. And so it's interesting over the years how teachers will respond differently when classes perform poorly as a class, as a group. And the exemplary teacher will invariably respond with, I must have done something wrong. The assessment didn't match my teaching. I didn't prepare them well enough. Things were too confusing. I assessed something too early. The marginal or the mediocre teacher will not absorb any level of responsibility and tends to put the blame on the students. And I can remember a conversation I had with one teacher, and I was just unwilling to live with the results on this final exam because I'd seen the results. And she was unwilling to make any concessions. And for the first time I can ever remember, and the only time I can ever remember, I had to actually go in and make some changes. And I told her that. I said, you know, if you're unwilling to do it, I will do it. Because what she had done was unfair to the students and was unwilling, just was sort of blinded. She had this blind spot to what that looked like. Those are not fun decisions to make. I don't recommend doing that, but it is a hard conversation to have and one that you're going to have at some level, unfortunately. Am I going backwards? Thank you. I should have said technology is, I'm pretty lousy at this. Okay, trait number 7. Gilbert Hyatt again from his book, Art of Teaching. It takes willpower then to prepare a course for teaching and to stick to the plan once worked out. It also calls for a good deal of sympathy with the pupils. While he makes his plan, the teacher is forced to ask himself, is this useful to them? Will this be clear to them without illustrations? Can they be expected to know this? And again, one of the things I love about Hyatt is a high-level academic, but he also, in his book, it's a great book for secondary faculty to read. He also appeals to sort of the rudiments of what good teaching looks like, even though he was an Ivy League classicist. So trait number 7, the exemplary teacher is organized, prepared, and purposeful. Organized, prepared, and purposeful. So planning really occurs on a micro and a macro level. And Hyatt actually addresses this as well. He says, preparation is usually done well on a small scale, but badly on a large scale. A teacher is apt to prepare his work for next day or next week and to neglect the job of planning the whole of his work for the term or the year. He often knows exactly what ground he will cover as far as ahead as Friday, but only vaguely understands how that part of his work will fit into the rest of the school year. It's only the far-sighted teachers who can draw upon a scheme of work and then stick to it until the terminal point at which they have aimed. So we're talking really about the micro level, not what am I doing tomorrow morning, but how does this fit in my scope and sequence for the year? How does this fit in my trimester, semester, or yearly plan? Exemplary teachers also use what's called bell-to-bell teaching. You've heard of that before. They start on time, and they use all that time to the end for teaching. In fact, one of the signs of a fairly marginal teacher, I think, is, oh, you guys got 5 minutes. Just go ahead and you can dismiss early or just take the time and chatter. That's not a good use of time. So the exemplary teacher uses every minute and wants more time. I love it when a teacher says, you know what? I can't afford to have more of these interruptions. Now, I hopefully want that done, and you'd want that done in a certain tone, right? A certain tone of a Christ-like tone. I remember one teacher who said, hey, and she was a good planner, but she said, teaching, she was a music teacher, she said, teaching is the ministry of faith and flexibility. And boy, she was a wonderful person to work with. because even though she planned, there'd be interruptions. That's just teaching, right? That's just the teaching life. There are going to be interruptions. There's going to be things that come up. And so we want people who are flexible, but we also want people who say, you know what, I can't afford to miss any more time. I need these kids. Can I get an extra period? Can you give me some more time? So those are, you want that balance. John Wooden, who was the coach at UCLA and is known not only as the greatest coach in the history of basketball, but is really known by many as the best coach in the history of sports. I've read a little bit about John Wooden, and Wooden was a meticulous planner. In fact, in one biography I read of his, they outlined what he did, and he did this with his own hand, but he was so meticulously planned, every minute was useful for him. He was so intentional. He was so purposeful. In fact, one of his ex-players tells a story of on the first day of practice, he'd get these top-level recruits, right, from around the country, and these top-level guys would come and play for John Wooden, and some of them had attitudes. And so on day one, John Wooden said, okay, guys, let's go ahead and take your shoes and your socks off. And guys kind of looked around like, what do you mean? We're ready to practice. Come on, we're ready to play. He said, no, take your shoes and socks on. I'm going to show you how to put your socks on right. Now, again, these are top-level recruits. This was Bill Walton who was telling this story, one of the best college players ever. And he's looking at John Wooden like, is this guy crazy? Well, Wooden had a plan. He realized that details are important. Talked about, hey, you don't want to get blisters, and you got to put the socks on right. Let me tell you how to tie your shoes. If you're college guys. And it took a few years for Bill Walton to understand what Wooden's purpose was. But take a look at one of Wooden's plans. 3:30 to 3:35. Notice how precise he is. Loosening up, stretching, twisting, bending, squatting. There was more there too. 3:35 to 3:40. You got a 5-minute window. Change of pace and direction. Quick starts and stops. 3:40 to 3:50. Dribbling. In place, right, left, alternate hands. Notice this level of planning for one of his practices. 3:50 to 3:55, ante over, rebound and pass out. 3:55 to 4:05, three-man lane, parallel, through middle, front and side. 4:05 to 4:15, shooting, baseline, board, perimeter jumper after quick drive. So we've just covered about, 45 minutes here only. This is a guy with a plan. This is a guy who showed up and was purposeful. He had his objectives, and he goes down as, I think, the winningest coach in the history, at least percentage-wise, in the history of college basketball, built a dynasty at UCLA. Great teachers plan well. They're very purposeful. They use time well, and they're highly organized. Todd Whitaker, great teachers have a plan and purpose for everything they do. If things don't work out the way they envision, they reflect on what they could have done differently and adjust their plans accordingly. Which leads us into the next trait, number 8. What time are we done? What time? We have 10 minutes. Okay, thanks. Effective teachers continuously practice self-evaluation and self-critique as learning tools. Reflective teachers portray themselves as students of learning. They're curious about the art and science of teaching and about themselves as effective teachers. They constantly improve lessons, think about how to reach particular children, and seek and try out new approaches in the classroom to better meet the needs of their learners. So trait number 8 is reflective and teachable. Reflective and teachable. The best teachers don't need to be told to reflect. You don't need to force them into that conversation. They do it already. Like that teacher I mentioned earlier, someone who says, that was a terrible lesson, that was a total bomb. Already making notes in her lesson plans to do this differently next time so it works better. A reflective orientation includes a tendency to analyze situations, question what is happening and why it's happening, to identify what student learning is desired, and to have a sense of self-efficacy. Thomas A. Kempis said, and this is true of all of us, this is our natural sin nature, gladly we desire to make other men perfect, but we will not amend our own fault. So being reflective and teachable isn't something that necessarily comes naturally. In fact, it's predicated on humility. And if we can bring humility into teaching and be open to criticisms, open to feedback, welcome that kind of thing, it makes us better teachers. The idea of metacognition, it sounds like a big word, but really it means thinking about your own thinking. I teach a class to seventh graders, and we talk about thinking about your own thinking, trying to help them build in themselves their own study skills. So these are questions that you can ask yourself. Good teachers ask themselves, are there new ways to teach this concept? How do I model this and guide the students through this learning? Am I consistently checking for understanding while teaching this concept? How much time do I have? Does the lesson plan need any changes? Is every child engaged during the lesson? Do my assessments match my teaching? How can I improve this lesson next time? Write notes on those lesson plans. Who might I consult for help in teaching this lesson or this group of students? Exemplary teachers don't have this know-it-all attitude. They add, even veteran exemplary teachers, they ask for advice. They seek other people out. So being reflective and teachable is trait number 8. One of the best books on that, by the way, is called Leadership and Self-Deception. Leadership and Self-Deception, I didn't quote from it here, but really attacks that natural tendency of all of us to blame other people for our ills. Right? We're so good at finding fault in others. It's the student's fault, or if I would only have more time, or if the administrator. No, the good teacher doesn't do that. Trait number 9. What do people remember from their early days in the classroom? They remember attitudes, fleeting impressions of calm, chaos, peace, or anger, ways of being. They pick up a teacher's habits, acquire a worldview by osmosis. Whatever worldview a teacher projects, her students are likely to believe for at least a very long time that her way of seeing the world is the only way. Because the skills and facts a teacher teaches are assimilated away in time, as a house's foundation is seemingly obscured by the house, a teacher must always remember above all things that what their students will remember is the teacher's daily attitude. That's a powerful, somewhat of a sobering reminder to us. So number 9, I called encouraging, positive, and real. One of the best things we have done as a school is we had everyone this year read a book by Sam Crabtree called Practicing Affirmation. And what we've tried to do as a faculty is with our students, K all the way up through 12, is send these reminders to parents and students of just highlighting the positive. Because it's easy to kind of get bogged down by negative and you need to do this more, or try this, or pointing out this uniform violation, whatever it happens to be. But just those sort of unsolicited positive connections with kids and parents. Send an email to a parent just for no other reason than to say, hey, appreciate having your son in my class. He had a great day today. He was participating well, asking great questions, done his homework. Just really appreciate having him, period. By the way, he had his fifth uniform violation. Okay, don't sandwich those things. Just something that is altogether positive. Robert Littlejohn and Charles Evans in their book say, teachers, because of the thoughtfulness and conviction required of the profession, tend to think well and hold their opinions forcefully. We're used to a high degree of autonomy in our classrooms. We tend to be trusted to do our jobs as we see fit. Strong thinking and strongly held convictions without consideration of the need for harmony is a relational and professional disaster in the making. So we have people committed to classical Christian education because they're well thought out. They've thought through things. They're engaged. They're intelligent. They've done a lot of reading. But we've got to balance those things with that sense of harmony, that sense of being encouraging and affirming and positive and transparent. Doug Wilson says, a personal example in the context of personal relationships is God's appointed means for imparting wisdom. By personal example, parents, and I would substitute teachers here, teach tone, facial expression, kindness, sacrifice, unspoken assumptions, and so on. It is the personal example that sets the aroma of the home. And I would say, It is the personal example that sets the aroma in the classroom. You've probably been in classrooms where just kids are, there's just a wonderful sense of being loved and being nurtured and being engaged and not afraid to make mistakes. That's a teacher who is encouraging, positive, and real. Proverbs 3:27, do not withhold good from those who deserve it when it is in your power to act. And C.J. Mahaney, this is actually from that Crabtree book, Practicing Affirmation. Mahaney says, talking about affirmations and criticisms, he says, and this is a different context, but it can apply to the school setting. He says, three identifications of evidences of grace for every corrective observation or expression of humor where someone is the object of the humor. That is just for the pastor's college students who are together each day. For the spouse, parent, pastor, church member, he says he wants the ratio to be more like 5-1 or 10-1. In other words, for every criticism or correction, 5 or 10 positive statements of affirmation. That's a real challenge. But it is critical in the classroom. Okay, and coming up to number 10. By the way, there was a study done in one of the books, I don't remember what book it was, but there was a study done in staff rooms, staff lounges, and they had researchers consider statements of positive, statements of negative, encouragement, discouragement. And so they did these studies, and they came up with, and I don't know how many schools they did it in, but it was an official study that was cited. And they said, in the staff room, lunchtime, 94% of the statements were negative. That's overwhelming. 94%. And so staff rooms tend to be those places that where people go to vent or to complain or anything. Hopefully that's not true in our schools, and there are some things we can do to prevent that and to encourage otherwise. And Crabtree's book is one that I would recommend. Trait 10, the absence of objective means of assessment, clear goals and standards, means that no one can assess education except the educators, who are the only legitimate interpreters of the new science of education. A great book by Henry Edmondson on Dewey's influence on modern education. So number 10 is results-driven. Results-driven. James Strong, in his book, Qualities of Effective Teachers, says, and this is why I listed it as 10, because ultimately, the proof of teacher effectiveness is student results. The student should be able to read better, compute math more accurately, demonstrate a better understanding of his or her place in the world, or show other worthy achievements. In other words, measuring teacher success merely by teaching processes is not enough. Outcomes count. Are kids improving in the skills that we're trying to teach? And this goes beyond academics as well, and we'll get at that here in a minute. So exemplary teachers plan according to curricular goals and objectives. These are just little things that help teachers reach their objectives and their goals. They use various techniques to teach. Don't lean heavily on one method. They use homework appropriately and effectively. They monitor learning consistently to ensure all students are learning. They check for understanding continually with all students. They provide feedback. And they teach to the correct level of difficulty. And like we talked about earlier, exemplary teachers accept responsibility when students aren't learning. Louis Auchincloss wrote a book called The Rector of Justin. It's actually a novel. And it's about a headmaster. I can't get into the details, but it's an interesting book. And in that book, there's a quote from the headmaster who says this: the greatness of the private school is not that it produces geniuses. They grow anyway and can't be made. But that it can produce sometimes, but it can sometimes turn a third-rate student into a second-rate one. We can't boast publicly of such triumphs, but they are still our glory. Our goal as we teach is to help all students grow in wisdom and knowledge. And then this great book, Climbing Parnassus, Tracy Lee Simmons, says liberal education ought not to aim ought to aim not just at furnishing the mind with serviceable knowledge and information, not even at habituating the mind to rational methods, but at leading it to wisdom, to a quality of knowledge tempered by experience and imbued with understanding. It should, in a word, humanize. And when we talk about humanize, we're talking about Christ-likeness. Christ was fully man, and he is our pursuit. He is our he is the God-man, and he is what our, what we want our kids to pursue as well. Quickly in review then, number one, lives a gospel-oriented life. Two, called to teach and serve. Three, student-focused. Four, loves the subject, loves learning. Five, engaging and inspiring. Six, has high expectations. Seven, organized, prepared, and purposeful. Eight, is reflective and teachable. Nine, encouraging, positive, and real. And 10, is results-driven. Finally, just some quick reflections as we close. Anything you would add or change to the list? You think about that. This is by no means a the perfect or the only list. What traits as a teacher are you particularly good at? What traits do you feel you could target for growth? If you chose one area to focus on for improvement, what would that be? How would you achieve that? What strategies would you pursue? And maybe which book from the list would help you grow in that area? So don't head out before grabbing a book list. I'll make sure those are at the exits. And thank you so much. Have a great lunch.